Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Veronica Raimo. Veronica is the author of four novels, the most recent of which, Niente Davvero, which Virago is publishing as Lost on Me, translated into English this month. This has been a runaway bestseller in Italy, where it sold 100,000 copies, won various prominent literary prizes, including the Strenga Giovanni Prize. Veronica also contributes cultural articles to various Italian publications, and her translations into Italian include work by F. Scott Fitzgerald, Octavia E. Butler, Ray Bradbury, and Ursula K. Le Guin. Welcome to Our Shelves, Veronica. I'm thrilled that you're joining us today.
Hello, very nice to be here.
So as I just said, Lost on Me has been a wonderful success in Italy. And having just read it over the past weekend myself, I can see why. I really, really fell in love with it. For our listeners who haven't had a chance to get hold of the book yet because it's just about to come out, could you give them a little bit of a taster of what it's about?
It's a sort of funny autobiography. I mean, in this moment, you know, it's very difficult to say what is self autofiction and what is, you know. So I'm sort of what I was trying to do is actually to put in question the issue itself of what it means to talk about ourselves, because I think that in any case our memory is such a fragile device that we cannot really, you know, use as a strong criteria to tell ourselves. So it's a sort of a collage of different moments of a child that then will become a girl and then a woman, trying to reassemble her life through fake memories and through deliberate invention and yeah, really putting in question her identity, because she cannot allow herself to be so transparent to herself, because she doesn't she's not sure about her memories. That's one point. And it's also a story of a family, so, and about people that can create a new family when you struggle very much to get rid of your own family, even if it's not a terrible family, but as you know, every family that moment should come when you want to say farewell to your family. And so it's also what it means to create a new kind of family, with not just with your lovers and partner and boyfriends, but with friends and people that you meet, and even books that, you know, there are sort of strong presences in the life of this character that sort of is me. And
Yeah, it's so fun, because I think a little bit of what you're talking about there is that your character, the character of Veronica, is very much not trapped, maybe that's too far, but she's very interested in the stories that the other family members tell about themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And also the stories that she tells about the family. And I love that. And I think you make very clear in the novel that so much of sort of the bonds between family members can be about the stories that hold those families together, and the kind of, do you remember this? Do you remember that?
Yeah, exactly.
And people remembering things slightly differently. And also her brother's a writer. And so there's a sort of sense of who's going to tell the story, and is there only one story to be told, or are there multiple stories about this family?
Yeah, exactly. I was not so interested in saying, in describing a girl that should arrive to be herself, because for me the point is more we should invent ourselves constantly. That's what I'm what I think is it's first of all it's funnier, and I think also now this kind of imposition we have to say the truth, to tell the truth, can be very violent sometime, because we don't always know what is true. We don't always know what we're really feeling. And so I think that sometimes contradiction and lies can be a more realistic description of ourselves, and also all this friction between our memories and the story we tell ourselves and the story that other people tell us and the vision other people have of ourselves. I mean, this is all this narration. It's much more interesting than the narration of a character than, I don't know, is supposed to talk about himself or herself and just speaking the truth. I don't believe in that truth. And I believe that literature is a very useful and complicated mean that allow us to do that, to mix together invention, fake memories, contradiction and lies.
The novel is also very funny. You're very good at skewering this family, I think, and showing their sort of frailties and the comedic elements of them. Is that quite fun to write? Do you find that comes naturally?
Yes, and that was also very much intended. I don't know, at the beginning, I was not thinking to write a novel, and I'm not even sure I can describe this book as a novel. But so at the very beginning, what I wanted to do was to write a comical monologue for a friend of mine. She's an actress, so we wanted to work together. So I was writing this theatrical play for her. That was just before the pandemic, so you know, it was very weird at that time to think about theater. We didn't even know if theater could keep on existing. So I mean, all these performative part of our life was totally, I mean, completely collapsed. So, but I kept on writing, and that's also why the book itself has this sort of structure that works with fragments, and I think there is also, I think you can feel that is a monologue intended for some performative purpose, and maybe it will become at one point a theater play. I don't know. So, but I wanted to write for her that she's basically a comedian. So that was the idea. And
Oh, fantastic! I had no idea. But now you talk about it, it makes perfect sense. The voice is so strong, and I could see it being performed in a really fascinating way. I hope that comes to pass. That would be wonderful. Let's move into some of our main questions now. You're going to start, I think, by telling me about a couple of books that are currently on your bedside table.
Yep. So one is by Jeff Dyer. I don't know if I'm pronouncing him correctly.
Yeah, Jeff Dyer.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of him because, I don't know, maybe he's doing what I really would like to do, mix so many different kind of things. So, like, autofiction and essay, and he also, I mean, I really like his kind of humor, and I like how he can sort of go through different issue and theme and mix them together in a not very resolved way, but a super inspiring way. So I mean, it's always quite inspiring for me. And I mean, this book is about the last days of Federer. It's basically, of course, not just about the last days of Federer, as all Dyer books. They are all about so many other things. And I don't know, I think that was quite beautiful reading it. I mean, it's still there because, I mean, I actually already read the books, but I want to keep on my
nice.
Yes, because I want to keep on, you know,
rereading. You want to go back to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Get it again.
And I think that a book about the end and about what finishing means today, it creates a link to the future. So one thing that I love about Dyer, and especially in this book, but I think it's a lot there's a lot of it in a lot in other books by Dyer, is that is an author that reveals the workings and the glitches beyond his writing. So all the anxiety and the frustration of the process. Mm-hmm. So that his work actually put in question the work itself. So if I have to think to the impossible biography that he was trying to write about D.H. Lawrence, for example. Yes. So I like very much when a writer shows all the struggle of the writing process itself.
Yeah, yeah, pulls back the curtain and tells you how it's going behind the scenes.
Yeah, exactly.
Where they're getting stuck or what is actually kind of... Yeah. And those books as well are fascinating. I think The Out of Sheer Rage, the one about D.H. Lawrence, for me is so interesting because it starts out being one thing and by the end it's a completely different book to the one that he hoped to write. And yeah. I'm always fascinated by those volumes that people, you know, start out to do one thing and they do something even better by the end of it.
And then in particular, there was something that for me was very touching in this book, and it's when he is talking about... Martin Amis' last book, Inside Story, and so it was short before. I mean, I read the book short before Amis died, and so in the and Dyer so is talking about his last book and saying that I mean that is a good book, but it didn't really appreciate some parts, and he said that he would have cut something like 200 pages, which can be a bit insulting somehow. But then actually for me was so touching, because I thought that actually it's comforting somehow to know that there will be someone after us who will read us, the stuff that we wrote, and maybe he or she will enjoy it. And however, they would enjoy it with maybe 200 pages less, or with other, with something different. So the idea that after we die, there are people that can read our books and find something that they would have done different. For me, it's a link to a post-mortem life. So it's really a connection to a future in which we can come back to what we have written. I always intend literature as a process. Maybe because I'm also a translator, and so I know how many times a book can be translated and retranslated. And I like to know that things can be done. I don't want to say that they can be done better, but different. And so the idea that things can be done and redone, and there is not an idea of perfection, is something that somehow keeps me alive as a writer and also as a human being.
That's so lovely. I had never thought of it like that before, but that idea of different versions of a certain text, someone else might read something differently in it, somebody else might think that it's better without that. And that sense of it, the text itself existing beyond the author, exactly. Right? And transforming in the process. How wonderful. And I think the other book you're going to talk about is a novel. I'm not sure this one's been translated into English.
So I checked. It seems no. So I don't know. No. I'm not sure if it's coming out or... it's a Spanish author. So the title in Spanish is Carcoma. That's a kind of insect. And she's called Laila Martinez. She's a young Spanish author. What I really enjoyed in this novel is so there is this topos of literature that deals with the concept of home. So either you have to come back home or you have to leave home. So, but home is always this, important place from where or to which people tend to go or escape. Well, here, home is neither a place of belonging or a place of of longing, but it's a sort of a, so it's not a starting point, it's not a place to come back to, but it's a trap, it's a curse, it's a prison, and ultimately it's a nightmare. And there are two main characters, so there is a grandmother and her granddaughter, and they are, so the book is organized into different monologues. So some, and okay, it's not so clear when is the daughter, the granddaughter speaking, and when it's the grandmother, and this and they are trapped in this house, and of pure violence, and it's like the the author is very clever in describing it's sort of an endemic depth of violence that we share between generation, and this violence is a violence caused by gender and class violence, and so I don't know, I thought that was also a different way to talk about gender-based violence, because she was using this kind of let's say stylistic feature of a horror narrative, and but also the device of I don't know, you say class rage, so I mean yes, so she made very clear how gender-based violence is interconnected with also a question of class, and how, right. So the, you know, we have this monster world with this patriarchy, but very, and I don't know, not, it's not so easy to identify what it is, but the two main component is of course there is a gender based violence, but there is also violence that has a lot of to do with a class status, so and it's a novel, so it's not, let's say, it's not that something about intersectionality in a in a very explicit way, but she's doing that through this horror narrative with these two women stuck in this house and trapped in this house where they keep on be oppressed by this violence that comes from a very distant place in and very distant time, and it seems a bit oppressive like that, but it's a very funny book. I mean, she's I don't know, I didn't say that. I mean, she has a wonderful style, and she's very funny. She's very sarcastic, and so it's,
okay,
yeah. I really love it.
Have you read any of her work before? Is this the first time you're reading her?
Yes, the first time, but I also think it's her debut novel, so that's
why. Ah, okay. So
yeah, for sure, it's the first book that is translated into Italian, but I also think it's her debut novel, yes.
Interesting. That sounds great. I hope someone translates it into English very soon, then I can read it as well. And next up, I think you're going to talk about a film. This is a very new film, isn't it? I haven't seen it yet.
Disco Boy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about this film. Where did you see it? Hasn't it only just been released? Is that right?
Yes. I don't know, I saw at the cinema a week ago or something like that. It was, if I remember correctly, at the Berlinale Festival. It's by an Italian director, Giacomo Abruzzese, and basically is he made a documentary film. So this is his first feature movie. But you can clearly see the documentary background he has as a director. Okay. And what I found both interesting on a dramatic level and on a visual level is a, yes, there's a compenetration in a way, but also a strange clash between, yeah, the documentary approach and some kind of very weird vision he has. So there are some, there are some images that are super surrealistic, let's say, and but then you see the documentary approach, and it's also a very original way to describe European history of migration without recurring to easy narratives that we are used to. And it's a film about, I would say, desire and violence again, and desperation and male fragility in a super macho environment, because it's a film about La Légion étrangère. And so there is this main character that goes, so actually, yeah, he enters in the legend, and then all his struggle to overcome his own trauma and to somehow protect himself from a choice that, of course, is not a choice anymore, because it's a sort of imposed choice. And it's not easy to talk about male fragility. And and I think this is a movie that it's very, does it in a very subtle way and a very poetic way. And also, I don't know, the director took long time to produce this movie, and I'm happy that he finally did. And you can see how, you can see also the struggle to make the movie as he wanted to do, because it's a very strange and original movie, and it's so different from so many other movies that are produced at the moment. So it's you see that he had a clear vision and want to respect that clear vision he had. So I can see why, it took so long to realize the movie, and and I think it's all there, and it's all there also is love to the cinema. So there are so many quotations from big movies like can be Apocalypse Now, and okay. I don't know, for me I still love very much to go to the cinema, even if you know everything now it's happening on Netflix or whatever, and watching that movie on a cinema screen was an experience. So to go to the cinema and still have an experience, a visual experience, I think it's something. So, this is something I'm very fond of.
Are you a big movie goer? Do you enjoy going to the cinema?
Yeah, very much. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose as a, even just you letting me know, you telling me that Lost on Me originally started out as the idea for a sort of a monologue. I suppose I'd love to know, when you watch these sort of films and the way you're talking about this one as well, are you very interested in the sort of storytelling process and thinking about the nuts and bolts behind it, like how somebody has put this picture together, how they are telling the story?
Yeah. No, and I'm also very, I like to know all the production problems. I know that seems, you know, very poetic, or but I think that from that kind of problem, you understand a lot about the movie itself, about the choices that the director did. And I like to know all the obstacles that were there. So if I have to think to, you know, one of the most famous example is Fitzcarraldo, of course. So all the thing that it's in the background and now problematic somehow, can be to do exactly what you want to do. It's something that I'm very fascinated. Even if the result is not exactly what I would like to see, but I'm very happy when a director has a clear vision, and even if there are so many, production problems, he or she keeps on doing and following the inspiration somehow, or keeps on following the inspiration even if the inspiration itself changes, which is something that also can happen. So instead of, you know, having to be very strictful and say, okay, this is the script, this is the casting, everything now should work and they can change my ideas, because if I can change my ideas, it will be a waste of money. I mean, I like people that waste money if they have to.
I love this idea. It's so interesting hearing you talk about, you know, the way that you're interested in sort of interrogating the writing process itself and how people put their stories on the page, how they put them on the screen, these problems that might have arisen and what it all adds to it. The way you're talking about, you know, Jeff Dyer showing some of the process, the working process. Yeah, and so many, this is a very kind of broad statement, but it's so often that people are very fixated on the end result and they don't want to see what's happened to get to that point. They want to see the sort of beautiful finished piece of art that doesn't show all the kind of what's happened behind the scenes. But actually that is a whole new way of appreciating it, I think, as well.
Yeah, I want to see it.
Our shells be back in just a moment.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes and I'm talking to Veronica Raimo about what it means to know about the problems and the sort of bits and pieces and nuts and bolts that go on behind the scenes when you're writing books, making films or the like. Next up, Veronica, could you tell me about a book that made you think about feminism in a new way?
Yes, there's this book by Catherine Angel, which is called Sex Will Be Good Again in English. And it's a book I translated together with another translator. And so, I mean, it made me think in a new way about feminism, also because of translation issues. And again, you know, I want to up to the
behind the scenes.
Exactly. So the little personal failure as translator, for example, she talks a lot about bad sex. And in Italy, we don't have this concept of bad sex as you have in the Anglo-Saxon world. So that was very interesting, as a cultural difference, because it's like in Italy, you don't need to use this expression. So then we decide to keep it in English, because we couldn't find an expression that was bad sex, that was meaning the same thing that was meaning and we decided to explain the first time, but then we didn't want to use a sentence or a paraphrasis to describe that, so we keep that in English. And another cultural strong cultural difference was the title, for example, because the title is actually the English translation of an expression by Foucault, which was in French, "A demain le bon sexe," which literally means good sex, tomorrow good sex. So, okay. Just, you know, tomorrow and then comma, good sex. So, but in the French, expression of Foucault, there was some kind of, irony. So it was like a sort of impossible, aspiration as a, so it's like, right. Good sex, we talk about that tomorrow. While the English translation is much more affirmative.
Yes.
Tomorrow sex will be good again. So you completely remove the irony from the French. And so to have a, so then we decide to translate we didn't keep the French expression of Foucault, but we also didn't want to be so affirmative, assertive as it was the English title. And I don't know, but talking strictly about feminism, I really liked very much, and I think it was really controversial point of view, especially in the contemporary debate, what she was saying about the culture of consent. And because, so basically Angel says that if post-feminism put such a strong emphasis about on sex positivity and assertiveness, what do we do when we have women that don't know exactly what they desire, what they want, or that are unable to express very clearly this desire? So it's not so easy to... So it's like, it's another kind of violence to, order a woman to be always completely conscious of her desire and her will and to express it loudly. And so I like this way in which Angel explores the dialectic nature of desire. And also, I like that she claims that this emphatic rhetoric that urge self-knowledge about desire is problematic because it represents, it depicts women as vulnerable, but and this is a point, but also reveals the horror of vulnerability, as she wrote. So I think that's quite an important point, to not to share a vision of feminism in which women should be absolutely resolved and strong and successful and winner. That's because otherwise you will get to this very, let's say, capitalist gap between winner and loser. It's really the same. So I don't want to think that there are Serie A women and Serie B women, and so we should talk much more about the concept of vulnerability than just trying to support empowerment in the sense that every single woman should be strong and successful and express exactly what she wants and maybe keeps what she wants. Because, I guess that very often that there is a sort of opacity between our desire and ourself. And also, I think that desire, for its dialectic nature, but also for its ambiguous nature can change, yeah. can change in time. So maybe what, and can change also in a very short time. So what
yeah, yeah, it's not a constant, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, and I thought it was a nice, I mean.
No, I'm interested because your work as a translator, it sounds like in this particular instance, the book obviously had quite an impact on you as well. Does that make you sort of more keen to then translate something? Or, I mean, if you're passionate about the subject, does that make you a sort of better translator, do you think?
I don't know if I am a better translator. Maybe yes, of course. Fortunately, I mean, I start my activity as a translator, I think, almost 20 years ago. And if I reread the first translation, I find them terrible. That's why I'm very happy that, you know, books can be retranslated. And I'm glad if someone will be, you know, will do a better job or a different job from what I did. But now I feel lucky enough that I can refuse books that I don't want to translate mm-hmm. because I don't like them or because I don't feel the right engagement or whatever. And so basically I try to translate just books that I find either beautiful or that speak to me for some reason. So and so it was happening absolutely with the Catherine Angel and and it was also as I was saying before, it was also very fascinating to resolve but not really then solving all these cultural differences between Italian culture and British culture about desire, sex, and feminism. So that there are some area that are still very separated, even if we are, you know, we all live in a West world and whatever. But and of course, I can say that Italy is very much colonized by Anglo-Saxon culture. But still, for some historical, social, and any other reason, there are still huge differences, and when you see this in a translation process, I think that I don't know, it's much more stimulating. Yeah, so trying to solve problems and then not solve problems because it's okay, but maybe the difference is, you know, is better than the solution itself. So it's like if you have this just little glitch or whatever, yeah.
So interesting to hear about it like that. I would never have thought there would be those. I mean, obviously, it doesn't necessarily surprise me when you talk about it, but at the same time, these little things that you wouldn't have thought might have been a cultural difference, but actually are, and they come out in these works. And how you deal with them is so kind of important. Next up, I'm going to ask you about a woman or a person of an unrepresented gender whom you admire. And we've got a little bit of a link with translation here because you've translated some of this author's work, haven't you, into Italian?
Yes.
So who's the author?
She's Ursula K. Le Guin. I hope the pronunciation is Le Guin. I mean, I...
Yeah, as far as I'm aware it is, don't worry.
For example, talking about imperfect solutions, she's really the queen of them. For example, translating her sometimes could be very irritating because she's very chaotic in she's super messy in her writing, and so you were thinking, okay, but you get this quote here and you have the same quote from I don't know whatever a French philosopher or someone or Cicero anyway, and then the quote is different. You cannot do that to me. But then, I mean, in this kind of, you know, strong chaos, you see that she's doing that because she's really like a rapper, you know, you have to follow the flow. I admire her very much for because she's a she's someone who in her work about science fiction, she was able both to challenge gender stereotypes and general stereotypes. So because I mean it was very rare for a woman to write about, you know, to write science fiction, but it was even more rare to write a, let's say, a feminist science fiction in a kind of world where just men could were allowed to write science fiction, and this kind of science fiction was super militaristic and macho and whatever. So, and so she tries to write this space adventures, but without the mythological figure of the hero. And as we are accustomed in all the classic science fiction, but maybe in literature in general, and that was not simply, you know, a way to make this adventure more democratic, let's say, but also to undermine the extremely linear type of narration that that the hero carries with himself, because a hero want to, so heroes has desire, and this desire is to win and to conquer something. And so, yeah, I don't know. And she, and I also like her very much because she was a woman that changed her mind about her ideas and apologized, because there is this beautiful essay that she wrote, and then she wrote another, a different version of the essay about she came back to her former position and apologized because she was too arrogant towards critics that some feminists express against her. And so while she was, you know, dismissive at the time, then years later she said, you know what, you were right and I was wrong. And I don't know how many writers
or, yeah, the humility is impressive, isn't it? And the ability, exactly, and the ability to revise her own thoughts and to think and to see other people's points of view. And I suppose that's also one of the things that she did so well in her writing.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I ask you, when you first, do you remember when you first read an Ursula K. Le Guin novel, which one it was?
I think I was young, so maybe 15, and was the Left Hand of Darkness.
Yes, yeah. Okay. That, I think that's one of the, I must admit, I'm very underread when it comes to, like, okay, that's the one novel of hers I have read properly, and it's astonishing. It's unlike any other sci-fi novel I've ever really come across, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And also, I'm a little bit interested in this idea of translating sci-fi as well, because you've also worked on translations of Octavia E. Butler, mm-hmm, haven't you, and Ray Bradbury. Mm-hmm. So is this a particular, does one, I have no idea, so maybe this is a foolish question, but do you, once you sort of get into translating sci-fi, does that mean that more sci-fi comes to you for translating? Do you want to do more of it? Is it a kind of, is it a very niche genre that certain people do and certain people don't do in translation?
I don't know. Yeah, actually, it all began when me and another Italian writer and translator, Claudia Durastanti, that maybe you know, I don't know, and we actually curated together a speculative fiction anthology that was called Sister of the Revolution, and so it was a collection of these short stories by different female writers, and since that I don't know, they, I mean, Claudia Durastanti somehow, I mean, since her a novel just came out after that, and it was a memoir or anyway autofiction novel about her and her family. So she was not the, you know, sci fiction writer anymore. I mean, she did, well, after that translation, after I wrote a book that that was called Miden in Italian and The Girl at the Door in English. Mm. And that was also a kind of very light speculative fiction novel. So I was still, you know, in this kind of vibe. And after that, I got so many, I don't know, yeah, they asked me to translate a lot of science fiction, but I refused a lot of that because actually I just want to translate. Then it was more, was me actually proposing to translate for example, Octavia Butler, that was totally unknown in Italy, and basically,
oh, wow,
she's still unknown, even if I try to, you know, to translate her books. I mean, yes, also Ursula Le Guin is quite unknown. So anyway, I wanted to help to make these books have a new audience because... But I didn't succeed. So, but anyway,
it's early days. Yeah, it's early days. People will still discover the wonders of Octavia E. Butler and Ursula K. Le Guin through your wonderful work. So, that's for people to look forward to. And finally, then today, Veronica, to celebrate Virago's 50th anniversary, we're asking all our guests to recommend one Virago book. What is the one Virago book that you would recommend to others? Press on others. Make other people read.
The collected short story by Grace Paley.
Tell me a little bit about when you first read Grace Paley and what she means to you.
I reread her constantly because especially in this moment, I mean, I'm not working on a collection of short story myself, and and when I have to write a short story, I always reread Grace Paley because I think it's one of the best author that wrote short stories, and maybe because her short stories are not what you expect from a short story, where you know very often are very well constructed story with a beginning and an end and all in the middle or well done. Well, I feel reading her short stories that you have the feeling, it's like you get like opening a door and entering a room where there is a already conversation on, and you stays there and hanging around a little bit and listen some of it, and then maybe feels very connected to the other people in the room, and you feel that you know everybody, even if you don't. So you're there for a while, then you left all of a sudden. Mm. And I think their short stories has this quality. They start in an imprecise moment in the life of the characters. And then she left before you know how the story will end. And that's what I like in our short stories. And actually what I like in short stories in general. So when... it's real, just a fragment in the history of the characters, and of course I love our female characters and this sort of understatement irony they have the cute observation of small details and. But yeah, but what I admire the most is this kind of the absence of a clear structure. So the opposite of what you expect when you go to writing creative writing course and say, you know, you have to have this.
Yeah, she breaks all the rules. And
I mean, she doesn't care. Maybe I don't know. She wants to break, but so you enter in a moment and you then. Came out for, so I love her and I would love very much to write at least one short story as she does.
That's your task now, is to go and write a short story worthy of Grace Paley. Thank you so much, Veronica. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for sharing all your top picks with us.
Thank you.
Thank you everyone else for listening to Our Shelves, which is brought to you by the team at Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Veronica Raimo, and tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism and culture.